Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/AOIS21.
Welcome to It's Not Even Past, a history of the distant present, hosted by Evan Tucker and the production of the AS21 Podcast Network, brought to you by AS21 Audio. This podcast is available on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn, and audio.as21.com.
So, a few dozen of you, if you really care, might have asked where your once faithful correspondent has been. The answer is he's been writing this pod essay for many weeks that turned into months, and he's searched his mind for a podcast format which would bring him and you the best possible results and satisfaction, only to draw the conclusion that he should keep doing this podcast exactly as it is without the slightest possible change, except for this shaggy dog trick, which will become clear as the weeks go on. But mostly he's been reading, trying to learn the secrets of writers much better than he'll ever be, trying to figure out where his old fictional podcast, the podcast he was really passionate about making, perhaps mistakenly passionate, went off the rails, and trying to learn from the old masters how to make a coherent narrative and actually read the books he's always pretended he's finished and occasionally never even started. So in the next few weeks, which may in fact be the next few months, I particularly want to talk about two books whose eponymous characters are in the title. One is the most beloved novel in the German language. The other is a Himalaya of world literature. If you're listening to this podcast in particular, I'll take it as a given that you have some experience of those literary Himalayas which bruise your foot when you drop them. You know the type of writer who writes them. Joyce, Proust, Mann, Dostoevsky, Dante, Milton, Melville, Faulkner. You can be bowled over by how brilliant they are, but their writing often feels impossible to love. It gets incredibly dry for 100 pages at a time, and the act of willing yourself to read the book is itself part of the experience. Some artistic works are meant to feel like a struggle. Even the most worshipful Wagnerian can't possibly think that The Ring or Parsifal is filled barline to barline with notes that completely need to be there. And I'm sure that everyone who's ever seen 2001 without first taking substances realizes that there are any number of passages that should be quarter their length. Part of what it means to understand these works is to endure them. But Goethe is almost unprecedented as an example of a writer who began his career as almost the exact opposite type of writer and became a hermetic island of meaning as he aged. I have no doubt that for 200 years, millions of Germans have taken Faust to their hearts like very few works in world literature. It's documented all throughout the last two centuries that Goethe's Faust is an endless source of poetic wisdom for German speakers. But my German is pretty fucking horrible, and Goethe is said to be one of those writers who loses nearly everything in translation. When I compare translations and Eugewalt, I read three translations of Part One. It's fairly easy to see how some people are taken into thinking that this classic from a foreign time and place is terrible, when what's really terrible is the translation. The first two translations I read conveyed hardly any flavor at all, and I couldn't help but come away thinking what a pompous sage this Goethe is. But the translation of John R. Williams truly comes alive with all the playfulness and nature painting and vulgarity that Goethe must read with in the German, yet seldom seems to register in English. With Part Two, I read only one version, the one you can find online in PDF by A.S. Klein. And it was something of a bore that only came alive intermittently. Jesus, I'm not going through that experience again so soon of trying to understand Part Two properly when getting my head around the spirit of Part One was so difficult. And that's not to say that even in a great translation, Faust is anything but long-winded. And it seems to take half of Part One merely to gain its momentum. A number of pieces of classical music based on Faust are much more consistently enthralling than the original source, particularly Berlioz's Damnation of Faust. Even in the great parts of Goethe's Faust, there are any number of exhilarating scenes that run too long to sustain fascination all the way through. But if you want to understand what we're capable of as a species, you have to read Faust. It's the irrational side of Shakespeare, the Shakespeare of A Midsummer Night's Dream and The Tempest and The Scottish Play and The Merry Wives of Windsor, magnified to epic proportions. It's a work of art that stands right at the precipice between so many different human achievements. It stands in the middle of the transition between the classical and the romantic, even as it portrays the fault line between the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. It embodies the tension between rationalism and romanticism, paganism and secularism, between the idea that the world is a quantifiable place to be understood and that there are more things in the heaven and the earth than can ever be dreamt of by even Goethe. If Shakespeare set the stage for a quantum leap in human thinking, bringing our consciousness out from superstition into the world of understanding, demonstrating how humans are their most human when they think irrationally, and therefore that humans should not trust that our instincts are rational, at just the same time that Galileo figured out how to set clocks accurately and charted the true motion of planetary orbits, laying the stage 50 years thereafter for Newton to uncover universal gravitation and Leibniz to invent calculus and Descartes to create a firm boundary between philosophy and theology. In order for conceptual science to truly advance, the humanities have to advance first. I can't possibly prove an interrelation between the advancement of science and politics and the advancement of arts and humanities. But every time there seems to be a major scientific revolution, there seems to be a major humanistic revolution a little bit earlier. To get to Shakespeare, there first had to be Chaucer, Boccaccio, Petrarch, Machiavelli, Moore, Spencer, Montaigne, Erasmus, Rabelais, even Luther, even Marlowe, even the bard's near exact contemporary Cervantes. And we won't even get into the various classical authors from whom Shakespeare borrowed. And you could do an even longer list of great Renaissance artists it takes to create Michelangelo. But just think of the intellectual metamorphosis of classical Athens. It was only 3 years after Pericles first established Athenian democracy that Aeschylus premiered the Oresteia. When Bismarck said that politics is the art of the possible, I don't know if he realized that his famous quote had a double meaning. The quote doesn't mean that we have to settle for the next best solution. It means that by arriving at a better solution, the possibilities of every person affected by the new policy will be beneficially affected, and the possibilities of what we can attain in our lives grow greater. The more people can realize their true potential, the more the achievements just start flowing forth. A generation apart from one another were born the three great tragedians of classical Athens: Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides. The Oresteia trilogy in 458 BC, Oedipus in 429, and the Bacchae tetralogy in 405. Tragedy was a new way of perceiving, a means to express the fleetingness of luck and happiness and security. Obviously, I have no idea what it was like to be in the first Athenian audience to see the Oresteia or Oedipus or the Bacchae. But I think we all know what it's like to read a great book or see a great movie for the first time. When it's over, everything you thought you knew about the world is different because you are a different person than you were when you began. The best of art draws those thoughts out of you that you had no idea you were thinking. Art is an instinctual process, not an intellectual one. But once we've revealed those instincts, we can translate them into thought. In this case, the thought is that we are helpless against fate. And yet, at the end of the Oresteia, we get the idea that laws can stop the endless cycle of violence and retribution. At the end of Oedipus at Colonus, Oedipus, lowliest and most degraded of men, is still permitted to die with dignity, perhaps even a state of grace. Once tragedy revealed to us the truth that our lives are the playthings of fate, we can begin to figure out the limits of fate's power over us. A little younger than Euripides was the historian Thucydides. If Homer recited history as myth, then Thucydides wrote history as scholarship, nothing trying to convey the vividness of the scene, rather to arrive at the truth of what happened through examining primary sources and political analysis. A few years younger than Thucydides was the great Athenian writer of comedies, Aristophanes. The structure of Greek tragedy can be put toward a comic purpose, which can point out those things wrong with society, hold out the possibility that we are not at the mercy of the gods, and that if we try hard enough, if we want it desperately enough, and most importantly, if we are clever enough, then the solution to intractable problems could be fixed. The most famous example of this is probably Lysistrata, the anti-war play in which women refused to sleep with their husbands until they stopped making war. Then came the great philosophers, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle. Socrates established a method by which we could arrive at greater certainties through skepticism. Plato applies Socrates' methods to ask what, if anything, we can truly know. Aristotle establishes that some things, in fact, can be known, and begins to turn his philosophic knowledge toward hard science of virtually all types, a turn continued after his death by Theophrastus. But one of Aristotle's students is Alexander the Great, who turns all of Greece into an empire, and there ends the Athenian Golden Age. The irony is that the accumulation of humanistic knowledge in this Golden Age became so vast that this Golden Age facilitated its own demise. But that's true every time knowledge is accumulated. Knowledge is ultimately value neutral. And knowledge that was once to our benefit then becomes to the benefit of our destruction. The key is to switch, to find new avenues of knowledge to discover so that our, at this point, dangerously comfortable assumptions can be properly challenged. Nevertheless, from this golden age, we have the birth of drama, of philosophy, of history, and of science. And the result was unquestionably to the benefit of all humanity thereafter. All of them existed before classical Athenian democracy, but none of them existed in any manner that we'd find particularly recognizable. Once we have Athens, it was only a matter of time before the conceptual knowledge of Athens is converted into harder knowledge. 100 years later, Euclid figured out geometry and factors and prime and perfect numbers. Once mathematics is properly established, so then can hard science. 100 years after Euclid, Archimedes figures out pi and from pi makes a screw. A generation after that, Eratosthenes figures out prime numbers, correctly measures the circumference of the earth, and makes the earth's first map. A generation after him, Hipparchus figures out trigonometry and the orbit of the moon and how to predict equinoxes. This is what it means to have broad humanistic knowledge. Once you better understand the hard lessons of politics, you can more freely express yourself. And once you can more freely express yourself, you naturally find an avenue for it through the arts. And you begin to better understand the meaning of how valuable that is when you better understand the arts. Once you better understand the hard lessons of the arts, you begin to better understand history. Once you better understand the hard lessons of history, you begin to better understand philosophy. Once you better understand the hard lessons of philosophy, you begin to better understand math. Once you better understand the hard lessons of math, you begin to better understand science. Once you better understand the hard lessons of science, you begin to better understand technology. And the development of technology is clearly what makes whole new conceptions of politics necessary. But Goethe represents perhaps a third quantum leap, or at least a prelude to one, completely reversed in nature from Shakespeare's. Shakespeare seemed as though he wanted to map human psychology with all our various thoughts and motivations, but the bard had to begin from a still quite medieval world, which valued man as just a small part of God's essence that God can always reclaim at his leisure. Few people thought human beings important enough to understand, so Shakespeare had to make the human and real into something magical. Even in Shakespeare's most rational human plays, intimations of the supernatural are always lurking and threatening vengeance, whether it's Hamlet's father or the storm in King Lear, or even in comedies where you think the supernatural has no place, like the miraculous survival of both twins, Viola and Sebastian, from a shipwreck from which there seem to be no other survivors in Twelfth Night. You could say that Shakespeare wants to map human rationality and show that it is, in fact, irrational. But in Faust, Goethe clearly wants to map the irrational rationally. Perhaps like William Blake, Goethe wanted to deposit this newly minted, supposedly rational man of the Enlightenment back into the world of spirits and demons. and record the findings with almost scientific precision. Goethe wanted to create a portrait of the devil himself, but not as Milton did, an epic incarnation of evil in a cinematic world of angels and demons at war. Rather, Goethe wrote the devil as a world-weary clown, a career bureaucrat who is somewhat incompetent at his job, with anthropomorphically human motivations, perhaps like a minor Greek god. This devil seems exhausted by the knowledge that the world is beginning to no longer believe in him, and plays bandmasters to a series of demonic parties with spirits who are clearly comic archetypes of the human unconscious rather than untamed apparitions of psychological terror. This is probably the seminal work in which all those thoughts which once terrified the human imagination get to strut about as something almost cartoonish, playful, even harmless. When I put it this way, this poetic drama might still seem as boring as its reputation, but consider two things. The first is that Faust Part I was published in 1808, the era when hundreds of years of religious dogma, perhaps thousands, is finally overthrown and Western humanity was, for the first time ever, allowed some semblance of a truly secular life, with some people, not even necessarily the rich, free to ignore the diktats of the church. Faust is so full of characters that it's clearly not meant to be acted on the stage, but rather a dramatic poem either read quietly by oneself or read in a group of friends or family. There were lots of English romantics like Byron and Shelley and Keats who wrote poetic dramas, but they really only started in any real way after 1808 when Faust Part I was published. Imagine, for the first time that wasn't on a Shrove Tuesday, which is the European way of saying Fat Tuesday, being able to act out Faust's explosion of demonic characters among your friends, saying all manner of crudely devilish things free from censure or approbation, and realizing that demons are not necessarily things to be feared but may well be cartoon characters of the human past. Once God and the devil no longer had a stranglehold on the human imagination, we humans were much more free to look inward to indulge our fancies and perceive how our imaginations work. And from that liberated inward gaze, we got the real third quantum leap. Realist fiction, non-realist painting, absolute music, and let's not forget, electricity, industrial capitalism even, and of course, liberal democracy. Or imagine enacting a protagonist in our minds like Faust, as we all do when we read good books. A character who gives voice to the same existential doubts that plague any thinking person about the efficacy of the supposed good we do, wondering even if good is good and evil is evil, and yet struggling mightily even so to evolve into better versions of ourselves, and willing to risk everything, even our souls, to do it. Art, maybe literature particularly, gives voice to those voices within us that we didn't realize even were there. And the first time people read Faust's in both senses phenomenal doubts on a page, most readers must have realized that something like this was what they've always thought and felt without even realizing that they did. But this rendering doesn't quite speak to why reading Faust, why reading Goethe, would still be valuable today. Depending on how the volumes are divided, Goethe wrote somewhere between 80 and 143 books, so it's not like I can give any kind of comprehensive overview of his work or define it in any truly meaningful way. But I can certainly contrast a few of his major works, particularly his two most famous. One, that legendary and thin-aired Himalaya of world literature, and for those who don't already know, world literature is a term Goethe invented. The other is Germany's most beloved novel, a book whose reputation he could never live down because everyone wanted him to write another Werther. But Goethe, like Faust and as genius must, was always evolving, always searching for new avenues of interest and expression to add to his storehouse of knowledge and re-evaluate his wisdom. More than any proper philosopher, he was perhaps the truest thinker the modern world ever had, the reason being that he was unencumbered by any system at all, and rather left his philosophical theories messy, half empirical, half Cartesian, and a third half metaphysical, never quite making consistent sense with itself. And rather than fit them into neat prescriptions of any straightforward theory, he continually hedged his bets, never settling on any fixed truth, as anyone who values the truth ultimately must. He didn't just write novels and epic plays and philosophy, but travel writing, autobiography, and whole reams of poetry, which many Germans have committed to memory. To me, this endless intellectual shape-shifting, this aimless following of wherever the mind takes you, not the creation of some quantifiable system of thought that seeks or purports to explain everything, is what it means to truly think. And it's this Goethe which we, particularly in America, have so little knowledge of, yet require so badly. Goethe means so little to the American mind, to the 21st century mind, because everything about his ethos is so far away from our zeitgeist. Harold Bloom, not always the most insightful critic, does have a good line about Goethe, which is that the wisdom of Goethe seems to come from another solar system than ours. What seems to matter in this distant solar system is just a pleasant, calm life of contemplation in which we all strive to take as much interest in the world's manifestations as we can. Its people, its nature, its laws, both jurisdictional and scientific, and even its potential metaphysical secrets. And in doing so, we cultivate an inner life rather than try to announce ourselves to the world in any outward manifestation. We never stop evolving into better and greater versions of the people we already are and the people we have yet to be. We never cling too particularly to our previous assumptions, and what we assumed about ourselves and the world in one year is not necessarily what we assume in the next. But this above all else, to perceive the world in all its roundness, instead of the small, flattened, perhaps even quantified and technocratic concepts we have of our world, in which code is binary and A is only A, in which we all cling to the beliefs we already have, to rather always be on the lookout for the interconnections between all things, rather than isolated within the same assumptions about the world that we live and die with. And by doing all this, the head and the heart can live in greater serenity and harmony than would ever be possible without embracing the constant metamorphosis that happens to us anyway, whether or not we fight to keep ourselves the same. This process is a word in German. Everything is a word in German. But this is a particularly important word that we have no equivalent to in English. Bildung. We in America have devoted so much time and passion to the extension of freedom, even if every American seems to disagree violently on what it means to be free. Yet how many Americans have ever given much thought about what all our freedoms are for? Once we've achieved all the freedom we could ever possibly want, whatever would we do with it? I don't think I need to give a long discourse about how the need for Bildung is related to American life. Most people listening to this podcast probably live an American life and know what it entails, and the non-Americans might see what's wrong with America from the outside even more acutely than we do. Whether or not one agrees that Bildung is something contemporary Americans direly need more of, I think everybody understands why someone who would make podcasts about the gradual accumulation of knowledge and wisdom would see America as needing much more of exactly that. But I will say two further things about Bildung. Bildung obviously had a huge problem. Those German speakers who devoted their lives to this self-cultivation could cast a huge shade of disapprobation on those who did not or could not be free to pursue the same cultivation as they, and in that lay the intellectual seeds of how Germany destroyed old Europe. Obviously, it generally wasn't the exquisitely well-read and refined bourgeois gentry who perpetrated Germany's worst crimes, but they did often look at Germany's crimes against humanity with indifference and sometimes even approval. We in contemporary America are obviously not Nazi Germany, and no matter what the Trump administration may be hiding in store for us, we will never be anything even remotely resembling Nazi Germany. We are America. And these days, that's problem enough. People, including me, who constantly fret that we're about to expire from authoritarianism, are probably still looking at the 21st century through the eyes of the 20th. We have more than enough existential crises right now without looking at them through the prism of existential crises of the past. At this point, I really doubt this is the end of America, or what's sometimes called the Pax Americana, though it could very well be the beginning of the end, because a lot of ends are not sudden, but extremely gradual. Perhaps the recent confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh is enough to make America into a one-party authoritarian state like Pinochet's Chile, because given a generation, a uniform reactionary majority on the Supreme Court, and please don't call them conservative, they're anything but, can dismantle the infrastructure of democracy. But America could easily become an authoritarian state, and it still would matter so little compared to other catastrophes which lurk just around the corner. We are already failing the existential tests of the 21st century with flying colors. Ecological catastrophe, mass extinction, nuclear proliferation, bioterror, $20 trillion in government debt, $35 trillion in personal debt that could be recalled and defaulted on at a moment's notice if history does not break our way, and eventually it won't. Excessive company profits and growth, often through the corporate data harvest of our personal information, and using that personal information to create fake news to keep us credulous about what the world's largest companies want us to believe. At this point, these are not problems that can be solved. They can only be survived. Every hard scientist and political scientist seems to have solutions to all this played out in theory. But no leader, not even an advisor to a leader, has the imagination yet to know how to enact creative solutions. Solving these problems, not just in conception but also in execution, can only be derived from vast humanistic training to learn, in which some of the interconnected metaphysical outlook of past civilizations are recaptured. Just because past societies fell does not mean that their achievements have nothing to offer us. And at the moment, we in the West look like we may become a society of the past just like them, so we need all the help we can get.
Much of what happened, what is discovered now, will of course be secret. We will not be given the full answer.
This has been It's Not Even Past, a history of the distant present, hosted by Evan Tucker. This has been a production of the AS21 Podcast Network, and brought to you by AS21 Audio. Find this and other episodes on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn, and our home on the web, audio.as21.com. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/itsnoteven past. That's it for this episode, but we'll be back, because the past isn't dead, it's not even past.
Copyright 2018, AS21 Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
AS21 Media. What do you want your story to be?